It is Saturday, November 22nd, 2014. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. And hello, I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch in the host chair today, and with me in the air room is Ben Jaffe, a teacher, traveler, and music geek.
That's me. I love that dot matrix printer. It's really musical.
It is, right?
It is, yeah.
There's no sound like it. Also, Miles Elam, a software engineer and political junkie.
Good morning. Although, I don't have quite the same nostalgia with a dot matrix printer. For me, that's the sound my dad made at 4 a.m. whenever he was really busy at work.
He just made a dot matrix printer sound?
He would print stuff out on our dot matrix printer. So that was my memory, like, 9 years old. Just like, oh, God.
Yeah.
His dad was actually a sound effects artist.
He's a Foley guy. Yeah. Yeah. That used to be so slow. Oh. Well, anyway, here we are for the day. Lots to talk about. There's been a couple of things that caught my eye over the week. One was rattling around on Facebook, some book, the Barbie book about computer engineer Barbie.
Oh, the Barbie book.
Where she's just like, I get to design it and the boys get to code it. No problem. Which was kind of funny because math was really hard a while ago, as I recall. But now apparently computer engineering is easy.
Math class is tough was the...
Oh, was that it?
Yeah, it was the exact quote.
I thought math was hard. It wasn't like a little... Anyway.
Also air quote funny because it's called Barbie, I Can Be a Computer Engineer. And yeah. She ends up not doing anything aside from designing the book and then getting a virus. Right. And then the boys have to fix it for her and it's just blah.
Right. Oh, not to mention the fact that she gets a virus on her sister's... computer Skipper, and they get angry, so they have a pillow fight.
Of course they do. Oh my gosh. Anyway, so a couple of hopeful developments in that story. First of all, the book was pulled from Amazon. Bye.
Yes.
And also, there was the inevitable and hilarious backlash of people fixing the book. There's an app now where you can, or like a website where you can go and fix a page of the Barbie book, and there's much more appropriate captions under
there. Oh, wow.
And that's something I do like, the riffing on that theme.
Yeah.
At the same time, the Barbie book's been on the shelf since 2010. Like, it's not like they were about to release it. They just released it and people saw a problem, so they had to pull it.
Mm-hmm.
It was, oh, the book's been released. It's run its main course, and now we're going to pull it after there's some backlash. We've already made our money off of it.
Mm. Okay, all right. So maybe not a perfect win for the, you know, the snide commenters on the internet.
That's my cynic's view of it,
Yeah. Well, and that is something that happens, right? There's a story that's been around, or a book, or let's say like a 14 rape scandal that's been around for a long time, and then there's just like a sudden bloom for some reason at a particular time because the internet latches onto it, and then it balloons and then results in some sort of action, perhaps a bit late.
Although this is something that happens in all aspects of human life. Like, how many bands have been toiling away for 15 years obscurity, then all of a sudden they hit it big and everyone goes like, wow, look at this new band. Like, well, we've been doing the same songs for 15 years, but suddenly people like us and we have this stardom, but 15 years.
So I guess there's no overnight success or downfall.
Yeah, right. I think that's the very positive side of that phenomenon.
Except for Justin Bieber.
Except for Justin Bieber. Sorry, Justin. Such a cute face. Anyway, if only Barbie were using twine, I think she might find it a lot easier to do the actual making of games.
Yeah.
What's twine?
Twine
for the person who doesn't game.
Yeah, well, I didn't know about it myself until this week. There's a great article in the New York Times, which we'll link to at geekspeak.org, that talks about the platform. And apparently it's the one that Zoe Quinn was using for her depression game. Zoe Quinn is one of three or so ladies that have been, you know, driven out of their house with death threats and so on by the Gamergate crowd.
Three or so that have been
reported,
have had the internet explosion about them.
Yeah.
This is not the total number of women, because that number is in thousands.
It's, who knows? Yeah. But Zoe Quinn's game is a text-based game where you explore what depression is like. and there's options for how to make things better, and some of them are crossed out and you don't have access to them. And so this particular platform seems to be particularly adept at exploring social issues like that, because it's more of like a storytelling text platform.
Okay, so it's more, it's text-centric?
It's like, text-centric, yeah. You can have pictures and stuff like that, but it's mostly text-based, and it's very easy to use in that way. Mm. And so
it's probably easy to create games in that way, too.
Well, it is, and to create them about non-traditional subjects. I mean, depression is certainly not the traditional subject for a game. It does have some people questioning, well, what is a game then? What makes something a game? And what makes it not a game? And are those things games? And when I'm a traditional gamer, game producer, maker, who has gone through all the degrees and everything to do traditional engineering, it could rankle me to see that these other, you know, gamers come lately bashing out a couple of lines of text and calling it a game, right? So that is, I mean, aside from just the whole like gender pall over the whole Gamergate scandal, there's also that aspect of you're encroaching on my territory. And so there's an interesting article about it in the New York Times, focusing on one of the game makers who is a male to female transgendered person who's made some very interesting ones and sort of exploring how to use frustration and denial of access as a gaming tool. It's very interesting stuff.
That's something I did want to say about the whole Barbie can be an engineer aspect is I don't want to denigrate game designers, artists, storyboarders. That's not the point. The point was that the book was called Barbie, I Can Be an Engineer, a software engineer.
Yeah.
And it would be very much like Barbie, I can be a top-level chef, but she doesn't actually ever cook.
Right. She goes like, here's a recipe I thought up. Make it.
Yeah.
I'm a chef. Yeah, so it's misrepresenting what computer engineering is.
And it also put her in a very bad light where she was basically incompetent, infecting everybody's computer around her and needing help from others. But also...
From men specifically.
Yeah, men, but also at the end, showing her game off to others and taking all the credit. And so it was just this really... There were no positive aspects to her role in this book above and beyond the aspects of her not being a software engineer in this book.
In many ways, that book is not helping. Yeah,
right. And a lot of the responses have been things along the lines of when we talk about the inventive responses. The people have had the
so
riffing
good.
On it.
We're going to link to that too, just all the different responses.
There have been ones that were saying like Barbie trying to do something and some guys are trying to help. She's like, you're messing things up. Here, let me fix this. Let's get this squared away. Mm-hmm. And doing things that are actually computer engineering things, but also making her the leader, the one that everyone defers to.
Right.
And
which is more appropriate to the job, right?
Well, it is if you're going to more of a managerial role or a lead role. But totally... fine. There was some commentary that I heard about that where people were saying, well, we shouldn't be teaching girls that boys are stupid. Like that shouldn't be happening. And my first thought with that was, how many instances do we have of boys being the ones in charge and women taking a passive role, having
boys can be stupid too?
Right. Having a few one-offs is not going to suddenly upend this paradigm that we have.
Yeah, yeah. it reminds me a little bit of the not all men response.
And also the very real truth, which is boys don't read the Barbie books.
Unless they hit the internet and are messed with.
But I mean, this thing of like, they're teaching that boys are stupid. It's like,
So what you're saying is you don't like it when people are portrayed as stupid. So maybe we stop doing that for the ladies. How about?
Yeah. No, I was saying that.
No, I'm not saying that you're saying that, but that would be a response to people who are like, no, don't make the boys look stupid. Okay, so let's not make anyone look stupid. Because apparently it's not pleasant.
Right.
Here.
So Amazon pulled the book. Good for Amazon. But also.
But also Amazon is in a large way responsible for pay inequity in Seattle.
Now this is confusing, and I had a sort of an argument with my boyfriend about this. I was disappointed that the woman at the top was not thinking of her.
You mean of Yahoo?
Of Yahoo.
Okay.
Oh, that's different. Never mind. Go on.
Yes.
Amazon. This is embarrassing. Okay, here I am on Geek Speak, and I regularly, like, in my mind, Google and Apple live in the same spot. Yahoo and Amazon live in the same spot.
If it makes me feel better, I did exactly the same thing and got laughed at work. For it. Right.
It happens to everyone. Okay, so human being stuff.
That's true.
But Amazon is hiring very quickly in Seattle, making a big push there, hiring 45,000 people.
All right.
In other words, 7% of the city of Seattle.
Oh, my God.
That's impactful.
Yeah.
See, numbers really take on a different meaning when you compare them, when you put them in perspective, right?
Yeah, the context number, yeah.
Now, the other context number that you have is 75% of those hires are of men.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So how does that square with the numbers of women trying to enter the field in general?
I can't speak to that. I don't have that data. But when you're looking at pay differences, before Amazon was doing its big push, women in Seattle were earning 86 cents to the dollar earned by men. Not great to begin
with.
Not
great, yeah.
Now.
Uh-oh.
Now with new Amazon technology.
78 cents per dollar.
Wait a minute.
That's a big decrease.
Yeah.
So they've impactfully hired a lot of people and also impactfully made it worse for the ladies.
They are hiring, in general, jobs that pay more than the median.
Yeah.
If they are hiring, 75% of the workforce that they're hiring is male.
Yeah.
Obviously that
those males are getting the bulk of the higher than average wages. Mm.
And so the thing is, you have to ask, is it true that on a 3-to-1 basis that men are more qualified than women? And that's the question, because that's the only way you can justify this, to say that, in the workforce, men are 3-to-1 more capable for handling these jobs than women are.
I mean, I would think if anywhere, the Seattle area would have a high concentration of women in the field of the men are getting at Amazon. But is that true?
I have met many women in Seattle that were in the Microsoft sphere, so I would
assume. So there are at least some. We know that. You know, I mean, is this like an Amazon problem a general industry problem?
But think of the fact that Microsoft has been there for many years, and that's where – and they have contributed either positively or negatively to that 86,
to that 86 okay.
cents per dollar.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And now there's Amazon a new tech company coming in where suddenly the number is dropping dramatically in terms of pay equity. Mm-hmm. So that's where the red flag comes up for me.
And so what about that? I mean, this news is out there. Is there any hilarious and scathing online backlash?
Well, apparently so, because we're reading it on GeekSpeak.
Yes.
Because if it's not on the internet, we don't know about it.
But it sounds like so far Amazon's like,
oh dear,
We hired some people. Not like, ooh, let's fix it. We're not at the
not there yet.
The complaint and response cycle has not yet
completed. It's still been difficult to get tech companies to publish their demographic data. Like Google has done so, Facebook has done so.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I can't remember all of the ones. Yahoo, I believe, as well. Apple has.
Okay. But Amazon, not so much.
I actually don't know off the top of my head for Amazon, so I can't speak to that. But
this sounds like one of those things we should follow up on over the weeks.
Sounds like a good idea.
Yeah.
You know, it's always interesting to me when companies like this get so big, or their actions within a certain sphere are so large relative to the sphere itself that they influence things like this. Like, it makes me think of Google Maps. So when Google Maps and turn-by-turn navigation first rolled out and everything, I thought, okay, you know, probably like 1% of people on the road or less are using this. But now a lot of people use it. And so I must imagine that Google is doing some kind of a load balancing thing where they're having some people go in one route, some people go in another route. Because if they have everyone go the optimal route, all of a sudden that's not the optimal route anymore.
Oh, wow. They're controlling the traffic.
I mean, when you get that big, then you're impacting it in some way, right?
Yeah.
There is some degree of social responsibility when you get that big.
Yeah.
And I guess Amazon is there in Seattle.
Mm. I just had a little dream of convening some sort of ethics and tech panel on Geek Speak. Wouldn't that be good?
Mm. Yeah. I would attend.
Yeah, right? All right.
I thought we were already having one.
Yeah, kind of every week. Every week is an ethics and tech panel on Geek Speak. But if that's a topic that's of interest to you, go ahead and write us, geeks@geekspeak.org, if you're in the field, if this is something in particular that you're exploring. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in talking to you and see if we can get you on the show.
Yeah, we'd love actual data.
Yeah, because we're good at the anecdotal and the surmising.
Oh, yeah, that's fun.
We're good
at
that.
And the pontificating in the soapbox, yes.
Yes, exactly. And we'll do more of that in just a bit here. You're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. Bonnie Jean Primsch in the host chair with Ben Jaffe and Miles Elam, and we're having a good time surmising and providing some anecdotal stuff and soapboxing and whatnot. Some interesting tech developments in recognition.
Yes, image recognition. So there's this technique, there's this thing called neural networks, which is basically where we've taken computers and we've modeled the way that they do certain processes after the way the human brain does certain processes. Mm-hmm. So, for example, image recognition. Humans are incredible at image recognition.
Yeah.
We're evolutionarily predisposed to identify cheetahs hiding in brush so we don't die, right?
Mm-hmm. Particularly faces.
Particularly, and also faces, right? Yeah. We have to identify each other.
Pattern recognition in general.
Exactly. Yes, generally, pattern recognition.
And not so much with the logic, but pattern recognition.
No, we are horrible at logic.
This has happened before.
Yeah. So there has been this massive breakthrough. It was announced on Google Research, the blog spot for Google Research. And they put together some neural networks in a particular way. And what they've been trying to do is take images and automatically provide captions for them. So that could be for accessibility on mm-hmm. websites, right? Let's say you upload some pictures to Facebook. It'd be great if someone who is blind could access that material by mm-hmm. having their computer read the caption. Uh-huh. But you, as the person who is uploading the photo, you're not going to provide captions for every single image, right?
Right,
so
yeah.
Wouldn't it be cool if the computer could look at an image and figure out what's inside of it? Now, this is really two different problems. This is the first problem of figuring out what the heck the things in the images are.
The image recognition part. And there's been some tremendous research in that, which you've covered in the past on GeekSpeak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but object recognition is really hard.
That's the hard
part. It's fairly easy to give some pictures to a computer and say, like, these are either pictures of airplanes or cats.
Yeah.
Tell me which one is which.
Okay,
that's easy because the subset that you're discerning mm-hmm. the image from mm-hmm. is relatively limited.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you're just like, here's an image, describe it, then you're having to call on the whole world of images.
What is this, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not going to go into any more technical details because that is a deep, deep field.
Deep.
I was talking to a machine learning person about this actually the other day, uh-huh. and that's why I have this story.
And do you have a link or something for those who want to go deep?
I absolutely do.
Okay,
yeah,
good. So that'll be geekspeak.org.
The link to the story, which goes into more technical depth, and then the actual paper for those who are like really into it.
Yeah.
But here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to show you guys some images, and I'd like you guys to generate captions. Just give me whatever detail you see in the image.
Okay.
And then I will read what the computer generated.
Oh, this is like that chess game. Okay, let's go.
Okay, so here's the first one, the one in the upper left.
I see a guy in a helmet on a dirt bike.
Yeah, BMX dirt bike.
Dirt bike, and he's on a track of some kind, and there's dust billowing behind him.
All right. The automatic caption was, a person riding a motorcycle on a dirt road.
Not bad.
Not bad.
Mm-hmm.
How about this one? This one right here.
It's a frisbee game, and one guy was trying to block the other guy, but he succeeded in throwing the frisbee on a lawn.
Yeah, people playing ultimate frisbee.
Yeah,
a group of young people playing a game of frisbee.
Huh.
All right. Tell me this one here. Now these are all the ones that the machine learning algorithm was successful with. Right.
Are those ponies?
Little elephants.
Oh, they're
elephants,
little elephants
from a distance. Actually, I shouldn't say little elephants. They're elephants from a distance.
Well, there are some young elephants in the picture. So
all right.
We're
anything
looking
else
in the, it's a flat area. There's like shallow puddles of water.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Flat plain with tree line in the background.
Great, and little bits of grass.
Uh-huh.
A herd of elephants walking across a dry grass field.
Wow.
So like really like whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa. That's amazing. So
were all the results that good?
Well, no, they weren't. But I.
those are some nice examples.
Before we make fun of the computer, yeah. I have to say this is really, really stunning. This is really
it's stunning results.
A huge, huge breakthrough here.
Yeah.
So let's go to the unrelated to the image captions. So
what?
So go ahead.
It's
and
like commentary captions.
No.
What do you mean?
Describe this one for me.
Oh. Oh, I see. Yeah, so this is a traffic sign, and it's a no-e-ing. I'm not sure what E stands for in this case. No entry, maybe? But there's like a bunch of stickers and graffiti on the sign obscuring what it says.
Okay, and
looks like it's at a subway station.
The computer thought this was a, quote, a refrigerator filled with lots of food and drinks.
Well, not quite.
So,
okay.
And then let's go for
bad examples.
This one right here.
Okay. A car decorated to look like a cute animal.
Yeah, Volkswagen bug with... buck teeth.
With buck teeth and cute little eyes and yeah. little ears on top of it.
And lipstick.
Yeah.
A yellow school bus parked in a parking lot? No.
No.
Wah.
It is yellow and a vehicle.
So there's definitely a ways to go.
Yeah.
It's not as good as humans. Yeah. Like, we're the masters at this.
Oh, good. I can still feel good about myself and my place in the universe.
But.
I mean, to be fair, there are quite a few people who see snow on the ground in the Midwest and think that there's no global warming. So... It's just as accurate. Yeah. So we can't be that hard on the computer.
Yeah. Oh, no.
To misinterpret.
That's true, because
you know,
we misinterpret all the time.
Yeah. So neural networks, machine learning algorithms, they're so amazing. And the more I have people who understand this stuff describe it to me, the more I'm just like, wow, this is – math is amazing. Math yields amazing results.
Ladies.
Anyway, this story is up on geekspeak.org,
okay.
And if you want to see more pictures and more examples, go and take a look.
Yeah. Miles, you've got a nice example of the police and the people working together.
Well, being in competition but finding some accommodation. Yeah,
finding some common ground and being able to have their needs met.
Right. Seattle PD was going to get one of the video cameras that we've been talking about so that they – film their interactions with the public at all times. And we've been big boosters of that, citing statements like it drops the number of complaints and the number of problems down dramatically in terms of police-citizen interactions.
Yeah.
And so they're moving along and spending the money on that equipment. When someone was saying, hey, you know what? I want to see all of those videos. So I'm going to put a request in for every single video for every day that, you know, that.
Like a Freedom of Information Act thing.
And the police department thought, oh, no.
Right.
Not this.
This is something I've also heard at university level as well. If someone ever said, I want all of your information.
Yeah.
The university would have to provide it,
yeah.
And it would be devastating.
Well, it's a personnel issue. It takes people away from other tasks, I guess, if you don't have a staff person dedicated to that.
Well, it's not just one staff person. If you don't have an entire department dedicated to that. It's a daunting task to try to organize the information in a digestible way.
Yeah.
And so they were looking at they might have to dump the body cams because they just can't deal.
They couldn't afford
it's not
the,
just a, yeah,
the it, requests to see the video.
Right, because it's not just a matter of, you know, hey, just upload it all to YouTube and
here's
you're
a
done.
Tape. Yeah.
Right, it's because there are privacy implications there. One, not everyone has signed on to having their mug up on in public
there's
view.
There's a consent issue.
There's also the issue of they didn't consent to being photographed inside their home. They're inside the home and videotaping as they're doing things.
Okay.
Like when I come
so it's
for,
like, hey, so thieves, just, yeah. Here's, yeah, why go to a place to stake the joint out?
Right. there's also the safety issues when they're talking to someone who has witnessed a crime to say, oh, yeah, this is the person that ratted me out. Okay.
Okay.
Like, there are all sorts of reasons why you don't want to just send all this data out to out to the public unedited or unobfuscated in some way. But there is a public interest in having access to these tapes because what does it matter if they're being videotaped?
Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah,
if the police are the only ones who have access to it, it ends up being very much like how it is today,
right.
Which is that complaint of, wait a second, why is it that the dash cam on the car always seems to fail whenever there's a complaint? You know, that type of thing.
Okay, yeah. So it seems important, like an important part of being filmed is having that film scene.
Right. So the Seattle PD, to their credit, they said, hey, let's invite this guy in. They invited him to the department. And they started
a guy who was requesting
all that information. Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
And said, okay, how do we deal with this? How do we get a workflow going? And they did what they've called a hackathon. In other words, you get a whole bunch of people together. You have a specific task, and everyone just keeps working on it until you have a working solution.
Right.
And so what they were doing was they worked out a plan where you could get the video, vet it in such a way, and then release it in chunks on a fairly regular basis.
Sounds like a digest.
To make it a workflow rather than having to process each individual request that comes in and have to get that data and sift through it and just give what they're asking for.
So in the course of this hackathon, they came up with just changing the way that that video gets handled automatically.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, first we gather the recorded material, then we edit it. Or obscure
faces.
Yeah,
redact what needs to be redacted.
Do all that stuff. And then just, then it's available. And then if a person makes a request, it's already ready to go.
Right. Or rather, they don't have to make the request because there is a place where they can go to get it that would be publicly available. It saves on the, I'm going to make a request, so I process it. Then they have to receive that request, register that they received the request, put it on file, then figure out which things that it pertains to, collate that with the videotapes that it pertains to, and which officers were on duty and which
research
archives,
and everything.
Then have to go through and vet it. If you instead just go, we're just going to go through the whole thing and make a workflow out of it and then release the stuff as it's available,
I mean,
it becomes a much easier process.
It's telling for me that just automatically doing all that processing work with the video is more time and cost effective than handling requests.
Or rather, you have to do the video processing anyway.
Yeah.
Why not get rid of that administrative issue of
just take care of it up front?
Yeah.
Well, nice. I'm glad that happened because you don't hear a lot of you want something that's uncomfortable for us. Tell me more. You know, usually it's you want something that's uncomfortable for us. No.
Right. And and kudos to the Seattle PD. They could have said, you know what, that's it. We're not doing it. Or they could say, hey, we're doing it and we're just going to stonewall you whenever you ask for a request. There actually was a dialogue there and a workable solution that ended up being useful for both sides. Because the Seattle PD now gets that transparency that people can see what's going on and they get air credibility that they wouldn't have had otherwise.
That's
nice. I guess something good is happening in Seattle.
Yes. Yeah. It's not just about women not getting paid.
Seattle's on the news today.
Yes, it is.
Thanks, Seattle. And let that be a lesson to all. Just like leaning in a little bit to an uncomfortable thing can yield good results for everyone. I know that air has water in it.
Especially in Seattle.
And I know that like...
I know that we have water in our air now here in Santa
Cruz. In Santa Cruz. And if I were like a water bender, I could just draw it out from the air.
Does it... Just to be clear, this is a very botched segue. This is if I was
something
listening,
has
I'd be
gone
like,
horribly wrong.
Did I miss
but
something?
But let's say I'm not a waterbender. That's the segue part.
All right, so I have a story about water and air.
Okay.
And so if you're in Seattle, you don't have to worry about running out of water because it's always raining. But if you're in a hot, a humid area, but very hot, and maybe you're, say, a cyclist. Mm-hmm. Well, gosh, I guess you just have to carry a lot of water with you.
You live in the greater Chicago area, for
well,
example.
Not right. for long. Well, there. So this guy named Christoph Retzar, he's an industrial design student, and he made a prototype of this gadget that you attach to your bike, and the humid air comes into it. It uses energy from the sun, from solar panels, to cool down the air and condense water out of the air and then drip it into a water bottle, which you can then drink while you're on your bike ride.
And does it work fast enough that when I'm thirsty, I'll be able to drink enough?
If you're in a sufficiently warm and humid area, then that's about half a liter per hour.
The times when you most need the water, those hot and humid days, that's when it's most available. That's great.
That's kind of cool.
Not good in a dry, hot desert.
Yeah,
but
not for Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
Then again, if you're in a dry heat, yes, dehydration is an issue, but at least you have the evaporative cooling.
Oh, that's true. That's a good point. You can stay cooler.
Oh, that's true. Just because you sweat, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, you're sweating and the sweat is evaporating.
Right.
As opposed to hot, humid days where you find like...
It just stays there.
It just stays there. Yeah. You're getting hotter and hotter and yeah.
So we're generally talking above 20 degrees Celsius or 68 Fahrenheit and over 50% humidity. Now, the cool thing about this is I
In other words, the Midwest.
Winter. Yeah. The cool thing about this is that he was doing all of this experimentation in Vienna, and you don't easily find those conditions in Vienna. So he like created this little laboratory or laboratory in his bathroom and simulated different atmospheric conditions. And then the airflow was from a computer fan, like one of those computer. And he experimented and figured it out and made it all work and everything. And so now this isn't for sale yet.
Yeah, it's a prototype, right?
It's a prototype. He said the prototype cost like somewhere between $25 and $40 to
okay,
make.
Okay, so that bodes
so this
well
is
for
cheap.
Yeah,
yeah. It looks to me just from looking at the picture like he's hooked up a Peltier junction.
Mm-hmm. You said a Peltier junction. What?
You apply electricity, and one side gets hot, the other side gets cold.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Draws heat from one side and vents
okay.
it to the other.
So that concept is in
right. For a short time, it was used for CPU cooling.
Okay.
Because you could apply electricity, it would try to wick the heat off of the CPU and send it to the heat sink on the other side.
Uh-huh.
And
uh-huh.
then you have a fan blowing on the heat sink to take that heat away from there.
Oh, that's why that's always warm on the back of my fridge.
So that's where the solar panel will be hooked up to a Peltier junction. That's where it creates the cold end. And then you have the equivalent of what makes your half gallon of milk sweat on a hot day, that cold.
Yeah. Okay. Refrigerators are similar concepts, different mechanisms.
Different mechanisms, but similar
concepts. But yeah, I mean, it's like $25 and $40. That's amazing. And if he gets this prototype into actual production, cost will be even cheaper than that.
That should scale nicely.
Yeah. So this is not also, just to be clear, this is not for the racing folk, because the racing folk tend to take off the reflectors off of their bikes because they don't want the extra half an ounce.
Oh, yeah. So
of
they're not going to put up with solar panels
they're,
and a special.
Not gonna, yeah. This thing collects air.
Yeah.
So it's basically.
It's making your bike heavier.
It slows you down, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I love the ingenuity.
Sure I'm sure someone wouldn't have it on their bike on a race. But then again, on a race, you have a lot of checkpoints and you have a lot of people doing this.
Yeah, you're going to get handed water anyway.
If you're in training, it doesn't matter so much that you have more wind resistance or
if you're hitting the open road on your bicycle, you know.
Right.
Then it's a way not to have to pack a lot of water and still be able to not dehydrate.
I'd get one.
Well, there it is.
Except I don't live in a humid area.
Well, you visit them. It's Geek Speak here on KUSP, and I'm Bonnie with Miles and Ben, and we're talking about all kinds of stuff. And let's get back to net neutrality. We covered it a little bit last week, but what's happening now, Miles?
Way back in November 10th.
I remember.
12 years ago.
Back
that's 2 weeks ago.
President
Obama said that the FCC should reclassify internet service as a utility.
Yeah. Which was a hopeful boost for people who would like net neutrality to be a continuing thing.
Right. But the agency that would do so is the FCC, and they so far haven't done anything.
Mm-hmm.
When asked about it, the FCC chairman, who is quite bullish on making these internet providers classified as telecoms and as utilities, FCC chairman Tom Wheeler, he is also very concerned about the almost certainty that these large internet companies are going to sue the FCC immediately after they make that ruling.
Okay.
And so they are waiting to try to get all of their ducks in a row, figure out all the legal arguments in anticipation of the fact that they're going to be sued so that they can try to address those suits as quickly as possible and actually get something done rather than be mired in court cases for the next 10 years.
This is where I appreciate that he's got a political mind.
Yeah.
Well, it's really hard to become an FCC chairman or be on the FCC in general without having a mind for politics.
Yeah. Well, I think any sort of position on the national scale, you've gotten some of that under your belt.
Yes.
But in this case, it seems to be, you know, it's a bit of savvy in the cause of something I believe in, so right. I'm approving of it.
But he absolutely, the real goal here, apparently, is that he doesn't want any ruling made to be overturned in court.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, to do that, you need to make preparations, and that means analyzing all the logical consequences of any decision that you make.
And is that in the news this week because he announced that's what he was doing?
Yes. He said publicly when people were asking, so why haven't you done it? I mean, Obama said you should do it.
Yeah.
You were appointed by Obama and...
And he's saying, and, believe me, I'm working on it.
Yes.
And so... I guess companies who are planning to sue are already kind of lining up their own ducks.
Right, they have no.
So it's not like he gave something away.
Right, they have no grounds to sue until the FCC actually makes a ruling,
mm-hmm.
and or yeah, so.
So it's like Hillary running.
They're almost certainly yeah. Well, for that matter,
she's getting really ready before she says anything.
A lot of these companies have probably been setting up strategies for dealing with being classified as Tier 2. For years, for decades, even. Mm-hmm. Because it has always been a possibility and has been talked about for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure they have a lot of this effort has already been made, and they will be playing a role of sticking to the status quo,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which is a lot easier to argue because it's easier to say, hey, the cautionary principle and precautionary principle.
You don't want it to get worse. It might, who knows? The unknown scale.
Right. You can't do this. You can't change this. We should stay where we are already.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The FCC is in a much more difficult position to say, here are the reasons why it has to change.
Yeah.
From what already is there and why it doesn't work right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ooh, well, good luck to the FCC getting all that to happen.
Good luck to us. I like
good
to
luck
say.
To all of us.
Good luck to all of us, yeah.
Aww. And let's see, elsewhere in the world, some interesting sort of shell game stuff, as far as I can tell, around online ads.
Yeah, online ads are interesting. So
shell game, really?
Yeah, like we're switching the money around, going, but everyone's getting the money they want. It's fine.
Way to color the argument before we even get into it.
Sorry. You're right. I'll keep my mouth shut. What's happening with online ads, Ben?
All right. So let's say you go to Mashable. That's a website. And you go to Mashable all the time, right?
Yeah.
And you see ads on Mashable.com. What's actually going on there is the advertising agency is paying Mashable to display particular ads, right?
And this is how a lot of websites are actually able to eat and make a wage.
Websites eat? That's how websites can pay for their server costs and everything.
For people who identify very closely with their website creations.
Our Southern California correspondent, Alex, actually has a site on Bearded Dragons.
Uh-huh.
Quick little plug. BeardedDragon.org.
What?
Or BeardedDragons? Now I need to look it up and see if it's BeardedDragon.com. But at any rate, he runs it.
He runs this thing. It's called Bearded Dragons, and it's a website.
Yeah. So how...
And he pays for it with ads.
Yeah.
And it is bearddragon.org.
Okay.
Oh yeah, there's an ad at the top.
And has for some time, and it doesn't make him rich.
Yeah.
But it does pay for the site.
Yeah.
It makes it so that
it's at least self-sustaining.
Right. It pays for the site, pays for and supplements his internet connection costs, mm-hmm. that type of thing. And that's what a lot of companies that have ads on their site, that's what
right.
it does.
And this has been the model that people who want to be able to have a venue for their writing and so on, if they have a website and get enough people with eyeballs on it and then sell space to Google Ads.
Yeah.
Right. If it became
they
more,
can earn a little something.
If it was this popular or more popular and he didn't have ads on it, it would actually start infringing upon his income. And then it becomes how much money am I willing to lose? That becomes mm-hmm. a very easy calculus for people to say, I'm not going to run the site anymore.
Right. So that's generally how things work.
That's kind of like
so
geek
far.
Speak.
Right? Yeah. Okay.
No, I'm kidding. Well, only kind of. But anyway.
We don't have ads.
We don't have ads. But Google just released a new, I don't know, product, I guess, a service.
Program or something?
Program. It is in beta. It's invite only. So this doesn't affect you unless you know it's affecting you. So that's for you and everyone else.
Some people are in this. Some people are not.
Some people
Most
are in
of
it.
Us
it's
are
called
not.
Google Contributor. And the idea is rather than supporting Mashable, for example, by viewing ads, you can support Mashable by giving $2 a month to Google, and then Google will, instead of showing you ads, it will pay Mashable every time you go to Mashable.com.
How is that different from just subscribing to Mashable.com?
I mean, the way Mashable works right now is that they show ads, and that's their profit model, right?
Oh, okay.
So rather than Mashable having to implement some kind of alternative way of gathering income or anything like that, this is like you basically are paying Google and Google is paying Mashable if you go to Mashable often, right? So every time you go to Mashable, they give Mashable a teeny amount of whatever amount that you paid them.
Yeah, one of the things about ads, and this was pioneered, I believe, by organizations like DoubleClick, since purchased by Google, but that idea being that earlier on, websites would host their own ads, try to figure out their own agreements with people and try to get that ad revenue. And it was really clunky.
It's a lot of admin work.
It meant that they had to reinvent the wheel every single site that you went to and try to figure out negotiating those prices with vendors.
So Google Ads is like a funnel.
Right. KUSP knows all about those troubles with underwriting. Like it's not fun. Of all the things that are fun about public radio, underwriting is not...
It's not the most fun.
Right. And so what you had with DoubleClick and other companies and Google and other ad companies is that you have a centralized point where they make these ads. That's where they deal with different with vendors that want to advertise and then target those ads depending upon which site you went to.
So, like, I
go to beardeddragon.org and I see
custom reptile cages.
Right. Yeah, something that has to do with
it's relevant to the material.
Exactly. Yes. And when I go to various sites, I'll see things mostly tech related because they've correlated those ads to me.
So up until now, you as a user of the internet you've never had an option to turn off ads. Now you could install a Chrome plugin or a Firefox plugin like AdBlock or something like that, and that would block the ads, but you're kind of getting around the system there. The reason that sites like Mashable and ImageUR and WikiHow and all those other sites, the reason that they exist is because they can survive on the payment from advertisers because you're going there and looking at and seeing the ads. And
so when you use like an ad blocker, you're preventing them from getting ad revenue?
Another way to say it is...
In many cases, yes.
Another way to say it is if everybody used an ad blocker, then the system would completely break.
Right,
and then those sites would probably either go away and die, or they would have to find some other way of supporting themselves.
And if I were to get like Firefox ad blocker, would I pay for that?
No, that's actually free.
When I view ads on a website, am I paying for them? Is money coming out of my pocket?
Not
money. You are not the customer. You are the product.
Right. No, I get that. That's the whole commercial radio thing. But here's my question. Now, I pay to not have the ads.
Well, it's... So you are paying before. You are paying in a way before. So let's say that you see an ad for something that you don't necessarily need, but it triggers you to think, maybe I should buy that, you know, or maybe I should buy that from Amazon or from wherever else. Now you go and you buy it and maybe you spend more money. So in a way, you are paying monetarily. But even if you aren't paying monetarily, you are paying with your attention. You're paying by looking at something. So it's not so much that you're paying monetarily, it's you're paying by the inconvenience or the annoyance of seeing the ads.
And that's Ira Glass's commercial radio argument.
Right.
That you can either pay by being pelted and annoyed by ads on a commercial station, or you could pay directly for the programs that you appreciate.
So it's kind of a way of paying directly, but by proxy of the people who would normally deliver
the ads.
But Google
ads still gives them money.
Right. Well, the thing is, think about the trials and tribulations that various news organizations have gone through. Places like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or all those that are putting, they're starting to put up paywalls to say, you need to get a subscription to us in order to see our content.
Yeah.
And they're all one-offs.
Mm-hmm.
And you may wonder, like, well, yes, I do see some news articles that I see from New York Times, but I also see very much the same story posted someplace else. Why should I pay the New York Times for that? And if for a subscription, and then I'm not going to have access to someone else. Pretty soon it's going to get...
You're arguing against the subscription model.
Well, it is still a subscription model. It's just a question of where does that subscription model go to? Do I pay for the New York Times and then go without the Wall Street Journal? Do I pay for both even though I don't... I may not even read any of the articles from Wall Street Journal that month and only from New York Times.
So I might as well give my money to Google Ads and hope that they trickle it down.
What you're doing
to
is you're aggregating just in the same way that DoubleClick did back in the day. You're not making the subscription to one particular site. You're making your subscription to news in general.
So I see.
It is important also to point out that Google Ads, even in the case that they're not delivering ads, they are providing a service, which is getting the money from you to the sites you visit.
So instead of me donating
5 cents to Mashable and 7 cents to Image URL, that'd be a pain in my butt, and I wouldn't do it, right? Mm-hmm. But if I can give $2 to Google for a month, and they take 20 cents or 30 cents or whatever it is, they are providing a service, right?
Yeah. And giving it to the folks that I'm actually looking at and not the anticipation where I think I might look at.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is in beta mode.
It is.
There's a pool of websites that are participating with Google, and there are a pool of people who are participating as viewers.
That's,
is that true?
That's exactly right.
Okay. And so I guess they're just going to test out to see if, you know, the logic that they thought of pans out in human behavior.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. I'm for it. I'm not necessarily saying...
I'm suspicious.
I'm not necessarily saying that I'll be a subscriber to that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
but I like that it gives us more choice rather than just saying, nah, you're just going to look at ads and that's the way it is because that's the way things work.
Okay. So it's about providing choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll see how it goes.
We will.
I'm not sure I would ever do it, but... what else is going on? The NSA still problems? What?
Well, that's a curious thing. People have talked about Snowden and, oh my God, how could he have let loose all of that metadata, all that data about NSA gathering domestic phone metadata and stuff like that. And as it turns out, an unnamed high-level NSA official had an internal disagreement about with the director in 2009 over the bulk metadata program.
Oh, it was a conversation
so
at high
Snowden
level.
Before Snowden had his... gave his leaks, and those concerns were ignored, not made public, not sent off to other branches of government.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so, which then raises that whole question of like, well, wait a second here, like, why are we vilifying Snowden if the proper channels that people keep saying that he should have taken?
Didn't work with a high-level NSA official.
Yes, even with someone at
so
a much
a,
higher level.
So A, Snowden wasn't alone, and B, what happened to the high-level official shows that perhaps Snowden made the logical choice for how to handle that information.
Or at least if you don't give any other options.
Then something else is going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Information will flow. Well.
And so what do we do about that? And Glenn... Glenn Greenwald, who is
the principal reporter on the Snowden files,
Who worked for The Guardian at the time, has put up an interesting theory. I don't know whether or not it would pan out, but his thought process is that it's going to be handled by the market. In other words, that companies that have a vested interest in users feeling that their privacy is preserved. That the NSA won't be able to look at their emails, for example. So there you have your Yahoo Mail, your Gmail, and Microsoft Mail that way.
Yeah.
That they have an incentive now to increase their security model to make encryption part of these things, WhatsApp being another one, where the NSA just simply doesn't have access to them. Oh, and we've run out of time. I'm sorry.
We ran out of time. Okay, so a deep thought there. We'll have links to the articles that inspired the beginning of this discussion at geekspeak.org. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of Geek Speak, please visit geekspeak.org. The theme song at the beginning of the show, Michael Newman's Pet Star Music. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe. Thank you for being here for our November 22nd, 2014 episode of Geek Speak.